Welcome to S&C's Critical Insights podcast. My name is Nick Borton. I'm a partner in Sullivan & Cromwell's litigation group, and I'm also the managing partner of our criminal defense and investigations group. With me today is my partner in Washington, D.C., Aisling O'Shea, and our topic today is COVID-19 and what it means for criminal and government investigations. We're going to be talking today about both the impact of the coronavirus crisis on ongoing investigations, and then we're going to take a look at the future of what it might mean for the future of government investigations and where the hotspots might be arising out of the COVID epidemic. Aisling, to start, maybe we could talk for a minute about what's going on now. So what has happened in the world of investigations? Where are government regulators? What are the companies doing that are under investigation? And how are those investigations proceeding?
So thus far, Nick, the U.S. government is continuing investigative and enforcement efforts unabated, working from home and trying to avoid the walls that may come up from telework like the rest of us are. But both the DOJ and the relevant U.S. government civil regulatory authorities appear to be pursuing their enforcement agendas full steam ahead right now.
Right. And criminal defense, the enforcement business is very much a face-to-face business. Companies and their counsel meet with government agencies routinely in conference rooms. A lot of the important discussions and negotiations happen face-to-face. Aisling, are you finding that using video conference technology or telephone calls at the same level of communication is happening?
I don't think that it's the same level of communication, and I think what we're finding is everyone is absolutely doing their best, but from my personal perspective, I still don't think that there is a substitute for face-to-face communication, but I think both in dealing with clients and companies trying to cope with investigative, regulatory, and criminal enforcement issues, as well as dealing on the other side of the table with the government, everyone is doing their best to make as much progress as they can and to do whatever doesn't absolutely need to be done face-to-face.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we're all operating on a, you know, do the best we can kind of standard here. We actually, a week ago, had a Wells-type meeting with the SEC, which was done entirely over Zoom, and it worked reasonably well, although like you, I think it's not a complete substitute for face-to-face. But for the moment, I think that's all we have. Another issue that I think is interesting is what does it mean for resolutions? I think many large companies in America, financial institutions, but also, you know, manufacturers, consumer good companies have been hit very hard by the economic consequences of the coronavirus epidemic. And I think it will be interesting to see going forward what impact, if any, that might have on how the DOJ conducts its investigation, on the scope of investigations, and perhaps most of all, on the terms of resolution, and whether the government will seek, you know, the same level of financial penalties that it might have, you know, even just a month ago when the economy was in much better shape.
I think that's an interesting point, and you might see something similar to what we saw in the economic crisis in 2008 and 2009, which really ran the gamut from penalties and other financial components of negotiated governmental resolutions that appeared completely unaffected by the credit crisis, as well as resolutions that explicitly took the effects of the financial crisis into account when coming up with a final number.
Yeah, agreed. So let's turn now to the future and engage in a little bit of speculation here as to what impact the coronavirus is going to have on the investigations practice going forward. What are some of the immediate things that come to mind when you think of how the world of investigations may change as a result of this?
Sure. So I think we'll continue to see enforcement in all the traditional areas, but we may see some investigative hotspots that result directly from crisis. Certainly one that has already been in the news is insider trading. We've read public reports of investigations into the trading patterns of certain members of Congress, and the co-directors of the SEC Enforcement Division actually issued a public statement reminding corporate insiders of their obligations to appropriately safeguard material non-public information during this period of time. So I think that is something that enforcers are certainly already mindful of, and is a risk area that companies are going to have to manage very effectively, notwithstanding all of the other demands on their time, given that so many companies are in crisis.
I think another obvious implication from all this is that as the financial connection between government agencies and large public companies and even, you know, medium-sized and small businesses becomes more intertwined as a result of the CARES Act bailout legislation, that will inevitably lead to more investigations by the government into whether that the money being disbursed as part of the legislation is being spent appropriately. I think we're going to see an uptick down the line in False Claims Act investigations, potentially in FIREA investigations for, you know, financial recipients of bailout money. There apparently is a dispute as to how much enforcement authority or how much financing the executive branch is going to give to the Special Inspector General for pandemic recovery, which is called for by the legislation. But assuming an agency like SICDARP is stood up to investigate companies' use of CARES Act financial assistance, I think those kind of investigations will be prevalent in the same way that we saw a lot of SICDARP and other law enforcement activity surrounding the recipients, but not only them, of TARP money following the 2008-2009 financial crisis.
I think that's right, Nick. And you mentioned the False Claims Act. The other thing to keep in mind, in addition to the CARES Act interactions between private industry and the government, is that there is radically increased interaction between private industry and government globally, including in countries traditionally don't have a lot of public-private interaction, because private industry is supplying essential medical goods and services to governments around the world. We're certainly going to see additional private sector development of tests and hopefully soon vaccines, we're reading about, which means there are a lot of private companies that are going to become government contractors for the first time, which has important implications under both the False Claims Act and more globally under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, because every time there is increased interaction with government, again, particularly for companies that may not have traditionally seen themselves as government suppliers or contractors, there are risks that need to be dealt with both under the FCA and under the FCPA.
And then finally, I think investors and securities regulators and others are going to look at what companies were saying about their financial health during this crisis, perhaps about the health of their key executives and other, you know, public statements that those companies made about their, you know, resilience to supply chain shocks and other things like this. And so I think inevitably we're also going to see disclosure-focused investigations involving companies' ability to withstand and to respond to the COVID-19 crisis. Before we wrap up, let's talk a little bit about the effect this is having also on our courts and on how the criminal justice system is managing. I think it's fair to say that the Bureau of Prisons has its hands full in dealing with the risks of a COVID epidemic inside the prison system. They are examining and their populations of inmates to determine who is at high risk for contracting the virus and which are the high risk groups if they contract the virus. And they are, you know, working to decrease the prison population. There's been a flurry of activity by defense attorneys representing clients in the high-risk group, and sometimes with the consent of and sometimes over the objection of the Department of Justice, they are making motions for the release of their clients. In the courthouses, it's a district-by-district, really case-by-case discussion, but a lot of the federal courts are now, you know, up and running using provisions of the legislation, of the CARES Act legislation, to conduct video conference hearings, both guilty pleas, sentencing, and other proceedings, which is certainly, you know, a first in my experience as a defense attorney.
And I think there are actually a number of very interesting criminal procedure issues arising out of the pandemic, Nick. So until the CARES Act was signed into law on Friday, providing a pathway to conduct criminal pleas and change of plea hearings and sentencings by video conference or teleconference, the case law construing the relevant rules of criminal procedure was actually uniformly bad on this subject. And so for the first time on Friday, the CARES Act provided a pathway for chief judges in various districts to provide, at the discretion of the judges, a way to do very important criminal procedural hearings like guilty pleas and sentencing by video conference and teleconference. And we've already seen the chief judges in a number of districts enter orders to that effect, in including the Southern District of New York and the District of Massachusetts.
And then at a more, maybe at one level of abstraction, there are also implications for statutes of limitation and Speedy Trial Act rights of charged defendants. I'm interested in your thoughts on what we might see going forward and what issues that might raise.
Sure. So we've seen a lot of activity already regarding the Speedy Trial Act in federal court and state law analogs, with judges in most districts tolling speedy trial under certain circumstances. I think that will continue to be an issue going forward. And more broadly speaking, how does the pandemic impact the imposition of statutes of limitations for time to charge criminal cases? Right now, there is no blanket way of dealing with this, but I think the government, when faced with grand juries operating at limited capacity in some districts and not operating in others, may find itself up against statute issues with respect to individual defendants, including in white-collar cases. We may see a lot more charges by information in the coming weeks and months if the government is eager to avoid running out the statute of limitations clock. And I think it remains to be seen for both corporates and individuals who find themselves the subject of criminal investigations what, if anything, will be done about the statute of limitations during the period that courts and grand juries are not fully functioning.
I think it's fair to say that for all of the topics we've discussed so far, at the moment, there are probably more questions than there are answers.
I think that's right.
Thank you for listening to SNC Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com.